Okay, I admit it. Sometimes I do go into the YouTube rabbit hole where I watch video after video. And for that reason, I would encourage you to subscribe to the Focus Core YouTube channel. That way, if you also find yourself in that rabbit hole, that you'll have some of the best videos, podcasts and case studies about companies that are thriving in Japan, and you'll be able to see and hear these real life cases that are relevant to you and your business here. So take a moment, open up your app, and subscribe to the Focus Core YouTube channel. Now on to our podcast.
Sometimes it was getting them to understand in the most pleasant way possible that Asia isn't an entity. Asia's many different cultures and countries. And I think to understand that the cultures are different across Asia, but something that I often found to be the case is decision-making speed could be quite different. So I think sometimes in my context in the UK and across Europe, hiring decisions could be made quite quickly sometimes. And I feel that in Asia, I think particularly Japan, I didn't do a huge amount of recruitment in Japan itself, but the limited exposure I did have to Japan, I think consensus and careful relationship building were much more important as part of that process.
Welcome to the Focus Core podcast, where we dive deep into leadership, talent, and the evolving world of business in Japan to help you focus in on your core business. Today, I'm very happy to welcome an old colleague and friend of mine, Damien Rhodes. Damien started his career with an unusual background, having spent a year as a monk before working in commercial due diligence. He later embarked on a 24-year recruitment career across the UK and Asia, encompassing executive search, workforce planning, and employee engagement. Damien is the founder of Talent Diagnostic Solutions, a consultancy that helps organizations make smarter people decisions across recruitment, engagement, and performance. He's a certified organizational coach with the Institute of Executive Coaching and Leadership and a Maxwell Leadership Certified Trainer and Public Speaker. He lives in Bath with his wife and is busy with their four children. And outside of work, he enjoys coffee, comedy, and dad jokes. Welcome, Damien.
David, thank you so much for the opportunity to meet you again and to be on your podcast.
It's wonderful. It's nice to catch up. We kind of did that impromptu webinar about a month ago, which was fun to catch up
Yeah.
online like that.
Have to have you on one of ours too, so that would be really good.
And we'll talk about that because you were talking about AI, so we'll talk about that a little bit today. But first, I think we need to ask and get the elephant out of the room is what's the best piece of advice you got from your time as a monk?
Well, the best piece of advice I got from my time as a monk, I'm going to start something really cheerful and joyful and upbeat. Keep death daily before your eyes.
Nice.
So memento mori. And although it may appear to be not appear to be particularly joyful, I think it's a powerful motivator. So to live more fully in the present, foster deep relationship people around us. And I think Gary Vaynerchuk, you might word it slightly differently, talks about memento mori as being having before us the idea of a powerful legacy, living without regrets and developing both patience long term but urgency in the short term. So I think actually the most motivating and cheerful advice I ever got was keep death daily before your eyes.
That's great. I love it. Well, now, what kind of monk were you?
I was a Benedictine monk, so a Catholic Christian monk. But the monastery I was in actually welcomed monks of many different traditions. We once had the Dalai Lama speaking with us. And so it was very interesting seeing different monastic traditions coming together and learning from each other. But it was certainly a very powerful year. But it wasn't my destiny. I think silence wasn't what I was called to be, I don't think.
And then, so you'd spent some time in Asia because we met when you were in Hong Kong, And now you're leading Talent Solutions. What's kind of shaped your philosophy of recruitment most?
I believe it's got to be human-centered, and that may sound blindingly obvious, but something I see so many companies doing and recruitment organizations doing is taking on roles where they haven't met the people that individual is going to be reporting to. So personally, I would never take on a role unless I've met the person it reports to, because culture, leadership, and people matter more than CVs. So I'll often say to an organization, when I was full-time recruitment, I'm not going to send you the best CVs. I'll send you the best people for this. So I advise companies on recruitment strategy now. And I say to them, find a recruiter you can trust, give them a limited time, and make sure the line manager meets that recruiter to really understand each other.
That's great. Yeah, I find, and you probably find this in the UK and the companies you consult with, that it's challenging with so many recruiters and talent acquisition teams being so inundated, and then also with portals trying to simplify things, trying to manage risk, that putting the person and the people back into the recruitment process is very difficult.
It is. It's very tough. And I realize, and I'm a big fan of AI and recruitment, so using the right technology and portals. But I think if you could have person-to-person understanding at the beginning, that just makes everything a lot easier.
Yeah, I think so. I remember working with my very first client was Apple. And they never had a portal. I worked with talent acquisition, but it was always about people. And they had processes that they could figure out. They could work their CRM that way, and it's a wonderful, much more personal way to work and get the right people for a company, right?
Absolutely.
Now you spent now tell me about you moved from the UK to Asia. How did that come about?
I moved from the UK to Asia. I was transferred to my previous employer, Robert Half, and so moved from the Cardiff office in the UK to Hong Kong. So quite a contrast going from a very small city to an international business city. And it was quite a very challenging time for me, and it was a very insightful in many ways. And I think certainly a lot I had to learn, and quite a lot I had to unlearn that process.
What did you find the biggest challenge for yourself?
I think one of the biggest challenges I found was how people are very polite. Many people in Asia are very polite, and I think that sometimes I would think, for example, realizing yes doesn't always mean yes in the way I would have understood it. So there's this polite ambiguity where sometimes I'd walk away from a meeting thinking a deal is done. Then weeks later, I find out it's not. And it certainly taught me a lot of patience and to double check everything and to ask questions in different ways and be more respectful of different ways of doing things.
So one of the challenges that you've probably experienced in Asia, and then I still experience in Japan, is dealing with culture gap and
Yes.
having, we understand in like in Japan where our client, where the company is, what the market is like, but being able to bridge that with home office or APAC and help them understand the local landscape. What kind of strategies did you find useful to be able to navigate that, or to consult people on how to navigate that?
When I was dealing with multinational companies, particularly organizations that had head office in the United States, sometimes it was getting them to understand, sometimes in the most pleasant way possible, that Asia isn't an entity. Asia is many different cultures and countries. And I think to understand that the cultures are different across Asia, but something that I often found to be the case is decision-making speed could be quite different. So I think sometimes in my context in the UK and across Europe, hiring decisions could be made quite quickly sometimes. And I feel that in Asia, I think particularly Japan, I didn't do a huge amount of recruitment in Japan itself, but the limited exposure I did have to Japan, I think consensus and careful relationship building were much more important as part of that process. And I began to see the great wisdom in that personally. But I think that organizations that don't understand that or misunderestimate that gap can get quite frustrated.
And it's it get the frustration goes both ways, right?
Yes, absolutely.
How did you bridge that when you were, in Hong Kong?
I think just communication. I think listening and communicating as much as I can to make sure that people can understand the different cultural nuances. And so sometimes we'd work with people from outside of Hong Kong being recruited to Hong Kong positions. It's making sure they understood at the beginning that it could be a lengthy process, and there's going to be more consensus built into that whole process. And I think, in particular, Japan, the time I spent recruiting into Japan and working in Japanese companies, I think it was also letting people know that the hiring decisions are going to take longer, but they also expect somebody to stay longer within the organization. They're not hiring someone to make an impact in 3 years, they're almost looking for somebody for life. And so they would put more thought and time into that process.
So that's great advice. That communication goes both ways. I know in Japan, when I'm working with a European company, and they're willing to do one interview and decision, and having to try and explain to the candidate that this is not a sloppy organization, this is just how their process works. And then on the flip side, trying to convince the client. Let's put one more step in there just for fun, just to help the decision-making process and make sure that the candidate feels comfortable. So that communication is certainly helpful, right?
Absolutely. And I think also in Hong Kong, decisions are made faster. In the rest of China, mainland China, they could sometimes be a little slower, more hierarchical. So it depends on each place in Asia. And I think sometimes I deal with people back home in the UK or in Canada or the United States who would say to me, I heard in Asia this, and to explain to them that I've been in Asia 10 years and even I'm beginning to understand the culture now. So I think it's being aware and being respectful of the local framework and the different values and decision-making thoughts in different places.
Yeah, that's excellent. Because I don't think that we would say, oh, well, the UK and Germany, they're both in Europe, so they must have the same decision-making process, right? You just wouldn't do that. So moving on. So let's talk about recruitment trends that you see. What are some of the kind of recruitment things globally you're witnessing right now?
I think in terms of recruitment trends globally, despite the fact there are challenges in the economy, I still think candidates do have a lot of power. I think that what I'm certainly seeing in the UK context, and to some extent in Canada and the US, is that people are very much looking for flexibility, purpose, and to work for the right people as much as salary. So for example, and I don't know how different that's going to be in Japan at the moment, but I find that in the UK, certainly when I'm dealing with senior positions like director level roles or C-level roles, organizations need to realize that the candidate is interviewing them as much as it is the other way around.
I think,
So certainly, sorry.
go ahead.
No, certainly hybrid working is the norm now. And so generally speaking, outside of financial services, in the UK for senior positions, most people expect to be in the office every day at the beginning, but then once they're settled in, it's usually 3 days in the office, 2 days working from home, and that's simply expected. And organisations that don't allow that flexibility are losing good candidates.
Yeah, same in Japan. Well, and then you'd mentioned also purpose. Talk a little bit around that.
I think in terms of purpose, I think the people, especially more senior people, purpose can be really key for them. And I think if they don't align with the values of the organization, and often the values of the person they're going to be reporting to, they're not going to want to work there. And so I think that That's why it's so vital that we as recruiters need to know the people it's get, that a role is going to report into.
That's great.
And so it doesn't matter how good a brand an organization has to some extent, if they don't like the person they're going to be reporting into, they're not going to want to work there.
That's great. Yeah, I think the priorities in Japan compared to the global standards have shifted a bit, because I think 5 years ago I would have put purpose number one,
Interesting, okay.
and I now I'd put that three. Flexibility is very important. I'm going to step back again. Purpose, though, I would say for older candidates, less important. Flexibility and money, more so. Young people
Interesting.
really want purpose. Money, not as much so.
That's counterintuitive to some extent, isn't
Yeah, I think part of it is just the economy now. This is we just finished up our salary survey in Japan. This is the first time ever that money's come out on top for motivational for change. It's always been, number four, number five, and there's the it, in Japan's always been fairly nuanced about that in comparison to the global standard. And so it's interesting now that you're talking about the things that we were talking about 5 years ago. Flexibility is important, purpose is important. And of course, working parents, flexibility is a game changer, but for single people as well in Japan, they want to work from home.
That's interesting. What's typical in Japan at the moment? Is it 3 days in, 2 days
Yeah.
out?
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's the standard. I think that's also shifting. I'm seeing more companies now nudging it just a little bit back, a bit more toothpaste into the tube, and going to 4 days now. And it's just from a recruitment point of view, it's like, oh, that's so tough.
It is, and financial service companies in particular in the UK. There's a big push towards 5 days in the office. And I think what's interesting there is that at the moment, there are lots of people looking for work, and so they can afford to do that. My concern is that once the economy changes and they're going to be needing to fight harder to get the right people through the door, that might need to change.
What from your point of view, your global lens, how do you see technology, particularly AI, playing a part in recruitment? Is it just a bunch of hype, or how do you see it playing out right now?
I think it's really interesting. I think to some extent, automation, for example, been in the recruitment process for quite a long time. I think that AI is absolutely vital for organizations to speed up sourcing and screening. What it can't do is replace human judgment. And so I think what's truly changing recruitment is market intelligence. So predicting talent shortages, looking at compensation trends and candidate behavior. I think that AI should be used. But to allow recruiters to become more strategic advisors and not just matchmakers. So, where in the past, 25 years ago, when we were recruiting before some of this technology came into play, looking at the CV and looking for keywords, that's not required anymore. And so, tech can do that. But I think to avoid the human element in that recruitment process altogether would be a big mistake. And certain large organizations have been stunned by that in the past, where older versions of AI would screen out people. For example, one organization I'm not going to name had an AI that screened out women based on keywords, based on previous hires. It looked at the people hired previously, found people similar, and it actually discriminated against people. So, from a diversity, equity, and inclusion point of view, we have to be very careful in terms of how it's set up. It's getting better every year, though, and so I certainly wouldn't name that particular AI because it's changed significantly since then. But I think that AI is absolutely vital, but I think use it to get rid of the administration side, not the relationship side.
Yeah, because we always talk about companies really getting rid of the people aspect of prejudice
Yes.
and being able to have that kind of blind viewpoint. And so you're telling me that it's also being used to discriminate as well.
I would say it has been used for that, but my caveat to that is I don't think anyone meant it to do that. I think it was set up to look at successful hires in the past, and it looked at successful hires and found out the names, for example, John, Peter, and James were hired more than people Jane, Emily, and Susan, and therefore it discriminated against, for example, women. I think where AI can be extremely useful, though, is, for example, removing cognitive bias. So, for example, where a human might subconsciously have a bias against people from certain cultures and backgrounds, if a technology is set up correctly, it can remove some of that cognitive bias from that initial screening.
That's interesting. Now,
So I'm a big fan of AI, but just in the right context.
yeah, absolutely. I think it's the thing I love about it is it's allowing people the chance to be people.
Absolutely. I
That's
have to say, I love shiny new tools. Any new tech, I'd love to work out what it does. But often I'm advising companies about their recruitment strategy. They'll say they want to buy a particular technology, and I get them to take one step back and say, look, what are the challenges you have at the moment? And what do you need to solve? Sometimes an organization, for example, has capacity to do what they want to pay extra money for. They're not using their current technology consistently, or people aren't trained on it. So it's understanding that as well.
Yeah. I think in, being in Japan, everything's a little bit slower just around language and, creating different roadblocks to getting it into the country. And I find that that's interesting in that we can watch all the mistakes happen globally before it arrives to our little island, which can be useful at times, I think. But I find that it's working globally, that often clients can be frustrated trying to work with their Japanese counterparts because that as well.
David, why do you think that is? Is that because of the belief in consensus and they want to make a decision in conjunction with other people, or is this a lack of trust in technology, would you say?
I think it's a lack of being able of language.
Interesting, okay.
So, I mean, don't forget that most Japanese still don't speak English that well. It's not like, say, Singapore or, other places in Asia where I think Japan is fiercely proud of their language and fiercely proud not to be so accessible. I think that's helpful. And that's partly a way to block out some of the noise. If you will. And I think that's because now, you have things that, like, say, translators, it does a completely good job,
Yes.
so it shouldn't be a big deal. But I think being for salespeople or for companies needing to make money, it's just prohibitive to come in. Well, you might as well go into India, for example, that's welcoming and English based. And allowing, that technology to work much more freely without having to do the added cost. And then there's the group, the amount of people there that make it worthwhile.
Absolutely.
So Japan's just a very small market at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's what I mean, you've done a lot around CFOs, finance directors. Do you find any trends around that? That's, kind of what we focus on as well. So.
In terms of what the universal traits that now companies expect for those. I would say a big one, but I would say it's not recently. I'd say for the last 10 years at least, beyond technical excellence, companies need CFOs as strategic partners. They've got to be commercially minded, comfortable with digital transformation, very strong communication skills, and that ability to influence as well. So if there's somebody who's technically a very strong accountant and good leadership skills, they can do well. But to become a CFO, they really need that strategic partnership and a vision to be part of growing an organization.
That's great. Yeah, that's exactly what we see as well, that business partnering is a key component, right?
Absolutely.
A lot of things can be offshored, or AI can take care of it. That's, companies
Yes.
are doing more and more of that. So they do need someone to be able to explain the numbers and the human element, to tell the story, right?
Yes, absolutely.
From your perspective, what's the toughest role to recruit in the market right now?
That's a great question because I love tough roles to recruit for. I would say the toughest roles I've ever had to be, I wasn't personally recruiting for these, but I was overseeing an RPO with a global bank, and they had a presence in Japan, and the toughest roles there were bilingual finance leaders. And I think it wasn't only knowing the language, but it was also the culture. So not only being fluent in English and in Japanese, but also fluent in understanding different cultures and how they fit together. So that was before I got to know you. So if only I had known you at the time, I'd have connected you to them. But at that time, really finding the right people to understand both the languages, the culture, and different nuances, I found that really tough.
What about now? What do you find is the challenge finding?
I think the toughest ch challenge at the moment is sometimes an organization, for example, the roles I've been recruiting recently have been heads of HR, CFOs, and some CEO type roles. Often organizations can be, need, some organizations need to be educated in terms of what's really important for them. So some people come to me saying we need a CFO who's also got experience as an HR director, who's also got that ability to grow and develop a company, who's also works in exactly the same industry, who lives within a 10-mile radius of where the office is. And it's understanding with them and having this sort of play of understanding where they're at, what they really need. And I think sometimes it's managing expectations. What do they really need for that role? I would say the roles I enjoy most working on are strategic CFOs who really have a passion for the business and who want to play a part in growing that organization. And I think it's sometimes I've found taking somebody from one industry to another could be very successful. When they insist on the same industry, sometimes it can hold them back because somebody's done things in a certain way throughout their career. Sometimes getting somebody from a different industry can actually have a massive positive impact there.
Yeah, agreed 100%. I think there's a lot of belief that, for a CFO or an HR professional that they need to come from the same industry, and most of the time they don't. Maybe some
No.
there's just there might be some systems that are a wee bit different, but they're pretty much they're interchangeable. It's not like a sales person that has their network in one industry, right?
Absolutely. And I think from a diversity and innovation point of view, you're going to get more innovation if somebody's from a different industry background. I once helped a CFO from a banking background move into a hotel, and that individual was asking questions nobody from the hotel industry would ever have asked, and was able to make a significant positive impact simply by asking the so-called dumb questions that he should have known the answer to if he'd worked in that industry. And it really forced people to think differently and think outside the box.
That's brilliant. I think that diversity is an excellent way for companies to really scale up in ways that they don't know.
Absolutely.
I'm working with a European pharma company, and they've just brought in people from FMCG,
Okay.
and just their mindset is one that's much more commercial, not and much more instead of being risk averse. And that pharma would be, and they just say, "Well, let's move things around this way and see how to do it." It's a different
Absolutely, and
mindset.
maybe they could bring a speed and sense of urgency that could really add to that organization.
So I find that in Japan, where it's very much a candidate short market, as you know, That's the one of the easiest ways to open up the funnel to bring in a few more candidates is just to look outside your industry. It's you can I've we were working on a project with a cosmetics company, and they recruited us
Okay.
for that, and they said we need this back office person to come from cosmetics, and we challenged that and asked why, and said we just need that, and we searched for 3 months. It wasn't until we could get a hold of the global HR person and have them in Japan to say, let's open that up because you're speaking about a very small pool of candidates. And once we were able to open up that funnel to consumer goods, FMCG, then we were able to bring someone in quite quickly.
And that's why they need people like you giving that advice and challenging sometimes what their initial assumptions are.
Well, speaking of advice and guiding people, let's move into leadership and coaching because you do quite a bit of that as well. You're a certified leadership coach, and then also in Maxwell. Tell me more about, I'm not sure about the Maxwell certification trainer, leadership training. I know, is that from John Maxwell? That's
Yes, it is. So set up by John Maxwell, and the certification I got was in executive coaching training and also in public speaking.
Okay.
And those are all things I've done before, but it's good to have that certification in it and get a deeper understanding in those areas. So that was really good to have. That was only a few years ago I gained that certification. The IECL one, the Institute of Executive Coaching Leadership, was almost 10 years ago. So that's something I've always seen as really important because I think as a recruiter and as a coach, there are actually a lot of intersections between them. I think it's about asking the right questions. And in recruitment, as you know, and I'm with yourself being a coach and a recruiter too, but in recruitment, we coach clients to define what success really looks like with candidates helping people articulate strengths and aspirations. It's about unlocking clarity and then deciding on a course of action.
For around leadership, what do you find, kind of the characteristics that are most lacking for people that are trying to move up that they can really develop before they take that jump up?
I'm going to make a massive generalization here. It's different for each individual person. I would say humility. And the reason I say that is I think the ability to listen deeply and adapt across cultures. I think many leaders assume their style translates globally. I think the best leaders are humble, curious, and open to learning. And I'm going to put my hands up and say that was me back in Asia many years ago, where I stepped into a leadership role. And I had my own Western mindset in an Asian culture. And I was working quite late one day, and I had quite a lot to do. And my team didn't go home. And I was thinking, oh, they're all really busy. And I walked past and saw none of them actually doing any work. And I couldn't understand why they were staying in the office. And it was me to understand and listen to them and appreciate that the way they've been brought up or the way they think is you don't go home before the boss does. And so I had to learn to become more humble. I had to learn to listen better. And so I think when I talk about traits I see lacking in other people, it's generally because I've seen it lacking in myself in the past. I ended up, and I'm not a believer in working late for the sake of it. If I had to work late, I would sometimes disappear for an hour, go and have something to eat, walk around the block and come back in again, that my team would all have gone home, and then I could get some work done without worrying about them thinking they had to be in the office. So it was adapting to different situations.
A nice boss.
Well, it could be sometimes.
But now you, I 9 out of 10 times I think you would speak to a leader and they'd say, "Aren't you? Are you curious and a good listener?" I would say 9 times out of 10, most leaders would say, "I'm curious. I listen to my staff." What, when you're coaching them, how do you reflect that back that perhaps they're maybe overestimating their abilities?
Their ability to listen.
and to, really understand what's going on. Because I think in some ways, a lot of us in leadership positions may overestimate our ability to listen. Like yourself going into a different culture, and you think you know what's going on, and you listen to the answer and think, well, it's just wrong. And before understanding and really comprehending, and it takes even more questioning. And I find that in Japan, a lot of leaders just ignore it. They might listen, they might think that they're curious, but they're not going one or two layers underneath the answers to double check that.
It's interesting. Part of what I do with Talent Diagnostic Solutions is going into an organization and doing anonymous surveys of employees of an organization or management teams and getting feedback where people feel safe to give honest feedback because they're not going to be named in doing so and reporting back to the organization. That could be a very powerful way of helping a leader understand how curious they have been, how much they're listening, how much they know about their own team. When I'm coaching a leader, there are certain tips and tricks I give them. So, for example, for many meetings, which are often done by Teams or by Zoom, most people have no objection to an AI note taker. And my own executive coach, because I'm a coach, but I need coaching myself, started using an AI note taker. And I had no issue with it. Then I realized the people I'm coaching probably wouldn't have an issue with it either. Then I suggested they used it in terms of their meeting with their people. And I said, have a look at the statistics afterwards. How much are you speaking and how much are you listening? I would say most were quite shocked at how little they listened. And I would encourage people to be comfortable with an uncomfortable pause, almost to count for 5 seconds in their head when asking a question to make sure someone really has finished speaking. That's something that doesn't come naturally to me, so I'm emphasizing it to other people, realizing I need to do the same.
That's brilliant. Yeah, I think in Japan especially, so well, in any country where you're dealing with someone speaking in a foreign language, people need to process, and it just takes time. And then in recruitment, we're asking tough questions, like, and it's significant. Maybe in the US it's not a significant change in your job, for example. But in Japan, much more so, you need to convince in-laws and spouse, and it can be a big life changer, and you need to be comfortable in that silence and wait.
Absolutely.
So from the rest of our podcast out, there's going to be long, uncomfortable silences. We apologize for that. Sorry, just a joke there.
Absolutely.
What's a now? For trying to get leaders to interview better, how do you guide them to interview for their candidates and to really help the interview process? What advice do you give them?
In terms of interviewing somebody for their own team,
Correct.
I would say make somebody feel comfortable. First of all, to set the scene at the beginning and to explain why they're interviewing somebody. Sometimes it may seem obvious, but I think to make it very clear at the beginning, it should be a two-way dialogue that you welcome questions as the interview goes along, not simply questions at the end, and make it a two-way conversation. And again, I think a big part of that is, again, things like don't let the first encounter be where somebody gives you a form to fill in. Make sure you greet people warmly. They're very simple things anyone can do and any organization can do to make the whole interview process a more comfortable experience. And there's a lot of research that says the more comfortable somebody is in an interview, the more open and honest they're going to be. So I think sometimes I've advised leaders to also be a little vulnerable to some extent and sometimes talk about their own shortcomings. And maybe this might be more counterintuitive, especially maybe in the Asian context. But I think sometimes when the leader says, sometimes I struggle in this area, Can you share more about some of the struggles you've had? People are much more likely to open up about things.
Yeah, agree 100%. I think that's simple things, smiling.
Yes. There's one person who fed back to me, said the candidates seemed really unhappy and didn't sound they wanted to be here. And the fascinating thing was the candidate's feedback to me was the person who met him. She didn't offer to shake hands. There was no smiling. There was no using a name. People have bad days. And so none of us get things right all the time. But I think that if people can become aware of that, and I think it's responsibility for coaches and also for recruiters to tell the truth and to tell people the uncomfortable truth sometimes. And so for me to say, I've said to clients sometimes, I've said, I really want to help you find the right person. I've got some feedback for you, which I think is going to really help you get to know these people better. Would you like to hear it? And I can see them squirming slightly, and I try and I, but I think it's important to be fairly direct sometimes, be respectful but direct, and let people know, because I'd want that myself.
Spot on. Yeah, I think that's it's good for recruiters to give that feedback on both sides of the table, and it to be as honest as possible as they can handle. And it also behooves can clients need to remember that their job and candidates' jobs as well is not only to evaluate, but traditionally the candidate was really trying to sell themselves to get a job. And now it's important, I think, for clients to realize, well, they need to be selling and make sure that every candidate that walks through the door wants to join their company while they're evaluating. It doesn't necessarily mean they have to accept the candidate, but they can make sure that they welcome the candidate in and want them to join that company.
Absolutely, that's so important.
But how do you think foreign companies should think differently about retention strategies versus, in Japan and the UK? How do you see the retention strategies kind of different?
In terms of Japan, the UK, again, it's generalization. I would say that my understanding of Japan is that retention hinges on loyalty and career development, especially. I think that in the UK, from what I see, flexibility and career progression is probably more important. I think that foreign companies investing in Asia need to make sure they really are investing in training, stability, and building that trust. I think that people in, my understanding, people in Japan are less likely to want to change jobs, but we do need to make sure there's trust and a really important relationship there.
Good advice. That's great.
And if you, and simple, like in any relationship, if you say you're going to do something, do it.
If you were advising a European, SME today who's trying to enter Japan, what would be some advice you would give them for recruitment?
I would say contact Focus Core.
Hey, there you
Obviously, that'd be
go.
the
Well
first thing I'd
done.
do, absolutely. So I would also say, if they're entering Japan, I would say don't underestimate the importance of your first hire. And make sure you absolutely nail that, because that person's going to shape your reputation, your culture, and your success. It doesn't matter what the values are on the internet for that business or up on the wall in posters in the HR director's office. It's that individual who's going to drive that in that local environment. And I would say, invest the time to get it right and lean on local expertise, because if you don't pay for local expertise, you're going to be paying a lot more money in costly missteps later on.
Yeah. And from your point of view, what kind of missteps do you see that happens?
What I've seen before is simply flying somebody in from a foreign country into somewhere like Japan or Hong Kong or mainland China or Singapore. And sometimes that's necessary and to have that. But I would say that individual, I think, needs to spend time listening deeply to people around them to really understand the culture and take advice on that. And I'm not saying you can't have a foreigner working in Japan. There's clearly yourself and so many other people have been successful in doing that. But I think it has to be somebody willing to listen and to really understand the culture locally. And try to go with a few prejudices that they can as well.
That's great.
Not to have too many assumptions in terms of what Asia is like based on knowing somebody from maybe a different country or different culture.
And it's not and it's you're not saying anything that someone shouldn't be aware of going into any country, whether you're going into, Brazil or Cambodia or Tokyo. You go into and you should be pretty open-minded for the culture. And 80%, I think 80% of most cultures are pretty much the same. You got to find that 20% that's different and figure out how significant
Absolutely.
that is, right?
Absolutely.
Got some rapid fire questions for you, Damien.
Okay, fantastic. Hit me with them.
Coffee or tea to start your day?
100% coffee.
Strange Englishman you are.
Well, a big coffee fan. I probably need to cut down a little, but no, coffee tends to start my day.
Nice. What one book would you recommend for everyone?
There's a book I'd recommend for everyone, particularly people who are maybe midway through their career. There's a gentleman called Arthur Brooks, who's professor of happiness at Harvard University. And so he writes a book called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in a Second Half of Life. And even though it talks about second half of life, the whole thing is about purpose, influence. And so he talks about how in the second half of your life, your cognitive strengths are going to shift. So it talks about the move from fluid intelligence. So, for example, fast problem solving, learning new skills, getting a little weaker sometimes, but crystallized intelligence becoming much stronger. So he talks about wisdom, experience, and judgment. And so people shouldn't fear different stages in life, but actually to embrace that. And to really look at how they're going to have purpose, influence, and impact. I think it's a really challenging and motivational book.
Right.
So if you're going to read one book, I'd recommend that one.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes. I know Arthur Brooks. It's a good one. Fish and chips or a Sunday roast?
That depends. Fish and chips on a Friday, roast on a Sunday. If I had a gun to my head, it'd be a roast.
What's your go-to productivity hack?
So personally, start early, do intense exercise, and then give yourself very strict time limits to get tasks done. I know from personal experience, if I've got 4 weeks to write a proposal, it will take me 4 weeks. If I set myself an alarm of 45 minutes, I'll get a significantly more done in that time. So I would say for anyone, I would say put time aside, but limit that time.
Awesome. What do your kids think you do for work?
They think I help people be successful, which I think is quite good.
Nice. London or Hong Kong nightlife?
I've got to say Hong Kong is where I met my wife, so I absolutely can't say London.
Nice. Sushi or curry rice?
This could be quite controversial. I like my fish cooked, so I would say curry rice.
Nice. Well, and biggest cultural shock you had working in Asia?
I think so I alluded to earlier. I think realizing yes doesn't necessarily mean the same things it does in the UK. So I think that wonderful politeness can sometimes we need to understand a little more. So not necessarily taking answer face value, but to understand better what people are really communicating.
That's brilliant. And we got in Japan, we say, yes means maybe, maybe means no, and no means you're speaking to someone who's not Japanese.
I like that.
Yeah. What's karaoke song of choice in Japan?
Don't Stop Me Now by Queen. But I have to caveat that with saying that I can't sing in Japanese, but I also can't sing in English. So I love most songs by Queen, but I generally would want to sing them on my own. or with people who already don't like me, so their opinion of me isn't going to suffer much afterwards. For me, singing is like dancing. I love both, but I'm not good at either. So, but Don't Stop Me Now by Queen is always a good one.
Nice. Well, we'll get you into a karaoke booth in Japan and see what you can do. So,
Absolutely, love to do it. What's your karaoke song of choice?
Queen's always a good choice. I like Lou Reed, "Walk on the Wild Side."
That is good,
That's,
isn't it?
yeah, it's a interesting song. Anyway, moving on. Thank you so much, Damien, for joining me today. It's been a delight to catch up after such a long time.
Absolutely, it's been really good to meet you again too, and I'd love to have you on my LinkedIn Live again very soon. It'd be really good to see you again and to catch up soon. Thanks so
Fantastic.
much for your time.
We'll put a link to your LinkedIn as well in the show notes, and so that people can catch you on LinkedIn Live. How often do you do that?
So I've been doing a LinkedIn Live as a guest on somebody else's weekly. I'm looking to do my own every other week as well, so.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to seeing that. Well, thank you so much, Damien. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks, David. Take care. Bye. I'm doing the uptown blow down.